Kazakhstan's president says the situation there is developing toward stabilization, this almost a week after his country plunged into deadly chaos. At least 21 people die in Pakistan after heavy snow traps them in their vehicles. And Iran reports its lowest number of daily coronavirus cases in almost 2 years. Hello and welcome from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us to Kazakhstan, where President Qasim Jomart Tokayev holds an emergency meeting to assess the situation that spiraled out of control over a recent fuel price hike. Security is tight around the presidential palace in the capital, Nur-Sultan. Earlier, the National Security Committee announced the arrest of its former chief, Karim Masimov, and several other officials on suspicion of treason. Masimov was sacked after protesters in the city of Almaty stormed government buildings earlier this week. Days of unrest have left 44 people, including law enforcement, dead. Israel's foreign ministry reports the death of an Israeli in Almaty. Meanwhile, the Russian president held a phone call with his Kazakh counterpart. Tokayev told Vladimir Putin that the situation in his country is stabilizing. Separately, Moscow has slammed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken for his remarks about Kazakhstan's call for military support from Russia. Well, January the 8th marks the second anniversary of an Iranian missile attack on an Iraqi air base hosting American forces. The attack on Ain al-Assad in western Iraq was in retaliation for the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani near Baghdad 5 days earlier. Iran says this attack was just a warning, and the ultimate revenge would be U.S.'s expulsion from West Asia.
On the 8th of January 2020, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launched a barrage of missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base, which housed American troops in Iraq's Anbar province. The attack, codenamed Operation Martyr Soleimani, was in retaliation for the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. He, along with senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were murdered near Baghdad International Airport on the 3rd of January 2020 in a drone strike authorized by former U.S. President Donald Trump. All of the Iranian missiles hit their designated targets as American forces failed to intercept any, despite a high level of readiness in their bases across the region in the wake of Iran's pledge to avenge the assassination. In the meantime, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, stressed that the attack on Ain al-Assad was just a warning. Trump sought to portray the missile strike as a minor incident. Shortly after the Iranian attack, he tweeted, "All is well." Later, in a press conference at the White House, he tried to play down the magnitude of the attack.
No Americans were harmed in last night's attack by the Iranian regime. We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe, and only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases.
Controversially, media reports along with satellite images showed that the damage done to Ain al-Assad Air Base was much greater than what U.S. officials had acknowledged. There were also conflicting reports on the number of those wounded. Despite initially claiming that the strike resulted in no casualties, the Trump administration ultimately announced that over 100 U.S. forces suffered traumatic brain injuries.
Our shelter filled with dust, shot into the shelter. Before that, we kind of accepted our fate.
The U.S. assassination of anti-terror icons General Soleimani and al-Muhandis raised popular calls in Iraq for the expulsion of American forces from the country. A few days after the assassination, the Iraqi parliament voted for the U.S. withdrawal. Amid the growing calls, the U.S. in December 2021 ended its combat mission in Iraq and limited it to an advisory role. Iran has time and again said the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and other parts of West Asia is the ultimate price Washington would pay for assassinating General Soleimani, who played a key role in defeating the Daesh terror group in the region.
Well, journalist and researcher Abbas Aslani says that Tehran regards the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region as a long-term revenge for the assassination of Iranian top commander Qasem Soleimani.
What is more important for Iran is the, American exit from the region, because Tehran defines the U.S. presence in the region as a source of tension as well as hostility. Iran wanted to show that it has the might to counter those, hostilities and actions against the country, and it can do it as in a calibrated way. However, it's also said that these kind of tactical operations will not suffice as a retaliation against the assassination, but Iran sees a long-term, revenge against that terrorist action, which is expelling American forces from regional countries. That one happened in Afghanistan, and the next was followed by the exit from Iraq.
Now it's time for this hour's news review. Saudi Arabia is pushing ahead with its deadly campaign of airstrikes on Yemeni cities. The latest Saudi airstrikes hit an area near the Yemeni city of Sada. Yemeni media say the attack killed a civilian and injured another. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on its southern neighbor in 2015 to reinstate a friendly government there. That objective has not been achieved, but hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed in the persisting Saudi attacks. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review, Jim Kavanaugh, writer and political commentator out of New York, and Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start it off with Jim. Jim, we're continually talking about the situation in Yemen. And once again, Saudi Arabia continues with its aggression. Do you think that the United States, if they told Saudi Arabia today to stop attacking Yemen, that it would, or is it something that the Saudis themselves are deciding to do?
Well, I think the Saudis are doing it on their own initiative, but I think it would be impossible to do without American support. The Americans definitely need to be a patron of this war. You know, Joe Biden came into the presidency declaring that he would end all military aid, all aid to the war, the Saudis' war in Yemen, but he didn't. And they just passed a $500 million package that includes money for the Saudi attack helicopters. So that's gone by the wayside, and the United States is supporting the war, is supporting Saudi Arabia in this war. And it could not, the Saudis could not do this without American support. I believe that. I think they have their own reasons for doing it, which are kind of dissipated in the last few. This war has gone on now for 7 years, longer than World War II. And, the Saudis thought this was going to be a quick victory that would enhance their credibility as a military power in the region, and it's turned out to be anything but that. But the United States does not want to see them defeated either. So the Americans are a crucial element and a necessary support of the Saudis in this war.
Elijah, your perspective, you heard what Jim said, the United States supports the Saudis in this. What exactly, from a strategic perspective, what do you think Washington is gaining from this? 7 years on, almost 7 years now, that this has been taking place, hundreds of thousands of people killed and displaced in that country. And, of course, we see the Yemeni military being very effective these days in fighting back. What is the United States trying to gain, and what have they gained, if anything, during these 7 years so far?
The most important point is that we all agree that this is not only a Saudi-led military intervention into the Yemen crisis and war. It is United States and and the United Kingdom that are offering military and intelligence support. It is Germany, France, Italy, Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom who are offering weapons, and there are civilian contractors in Saudi Arabia who are looking after all the Saudi planes that are waging war on Yemen. So we understand that the Saudis cannot execute a full maritime blockade on Yemen without the support of the United States. That takes us to one conclusion, that the United States is the principal player in this war and is insisting on continuing this war. Now, what are the reasons? It's because the Yemeni are rejecting the Saudi hegemony, they are rejecting the U.S. dominance over the country, and they own a very strategic area on the sea that is vital to the U.S. and to Israel. And what they fear is there is a new member of the Axis of the Resistance that has joined all the countries that reject the U.S. hegemony and want to live under the rule of the population and not under the U.S. dictate and all its allies. The main problem is not having a country that's saying no to the Americans and can represent a certain danger to the Israeli freedom of navigation and warship navigating in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is a combination of many things, really.
Well, Jim, if what Elijah is saying is true, and this is another addition to the resistance, what do you think with the continually bombardment of Yemen and also basically a blockade on the territory for years, that as a matter of fact, with what they're doing, they're actually pushing the Yemeni people more towards the resistance, because then it's the only way. They have nothing else. When bombs are falling over their heads and they don't have access to food and water, what other choice do they have?
Well, you make a good point. I think early on in 2015, when this first started, the Houthi-led movement was not necessarily going to be such a threat to Saudi Arabia or the Americans. We didn't know. But now it's clearly developed in such a way that they know what side they're on in the kind of regional and global situation. And, Saudi Arabia, as I say, I think got into this thinking they would just push, get their way very quickly. And because they haven't, and because the credibility of the Saudi regime under Mohammed bin Salman is now under, at stake in this, they can't afford a loss, and the Americans don't want them to afford a loss. At this point, the victory of the Houthi-led rebels in Yemen would be probably almost certainly lead to a new member of the Axis of Resistance, and it would be very threatening to the Saudi regime itself. But the failure in this would be devastating. And what you're going to have is, of course, the Saudis are going to depend on air power and naval power and bombing. It's bombing because they can't afford to lose soldiers, and they're not going to have a lot of, they don't do well when it comes to putting soldiers into play. And the Houthis have been successful. There's fighting over Marib, which is really one of the last strongholds of the Saudi governmental forces, and it's an important thing. So, it's a danger. It's become a dangerous situation for the Americans and the Israelis and the Saudis in a way that it didn't have to be, I think, at the outset. But they find a way of turning something into a problem for them, a much bigger problem than it could have been.
Well, Elijah, we've entered another year. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel this year for the Yemeni people? Because as our other guest, Jim, has just talked about Marib, and the victories by the Yemeni people, the Yemeni military. How likely do you see this conflict coming to an end soon?
Indeed, I see a very good outcome for Yemen, because we can see that the Ansarullah Houthis are liberating a big part of their country. They will definitely take Marib, and they are heading toward the borders. We're talking about Najran and all the territory that was disputed with Saudi Arabia, and they are really imposing themselves as the leader of the country. Saudis are losing the war. They just gained the destruction of Yemen, and now they have to reconstruct it once the war is finished and stops. So what we see, why I see it positive, is because I see that the Houthi gaining more territory, liberating more areas, defeating Al-Qaeda and ISIS that are fighting inside the city of Ma'arib and elsewhere, as the Saudis and their allies hold them to stand against the Houthis. So we suddenly see all these terrorist groups fighting in Yemen and the Americans closing an eye on them, and they support Saudi Arabia almost legally. So that's why this cannot continue, and they will be defeated and the Houthi will win. And this is why I see a positive outcome, because after 6 or 7 years of war, the Saudis, with all the big coalition that are supporting this war, have failed to achieve their objectives.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this news review. Jim Kampen, a writer and political commentator out of New York. Elijah Makhniyeh, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. I'd like to thank you for being with us on another news review. Thanks so much. I'll continue with other news now this hour. Iran has reported 700 new coronavirus infections, the lowest number of daily cases in almost 2 years. Some 6 million people have contracted the virus. 24 people died of COVID during the past day, bringing the overall death toll to around 131,000. Iran set another record low on Friday, reporting only 19 fatalities, the lowest daily toll in 2 years. While COVID-related figures have been declining in Iran, thanks to the country's mass vaccination campaign, over 122 million jabs have been administered. That includes more than 60 million people who have received their first dose. Some 52 million have also received the second dose, while nearly 10 million have received a booster shot. And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden's trip to Boulder, Colorado on Friday, 7th of January, marked his sixth climate disaster tour since taking office a year ago, underscoring the growing threat of global heating in the U.S. and the need for radical action to cut greenhouse gas emissions. We now present you an article written by Nina Lahani under the heading, Americans Can't Ignore Reality. Colorado fires highlight urgency of U.S. climate legislation. U.S. President Joe Biden ended his tour of neighborhoods devastated by Colorado's most destructive blaze, by admitting the link between America's escalating wildfires and the global climate crisis, claiming that the United States can no longer ignore the reality of weather conditions that have supercharged blazes. Biden's trip to Boulder County, Colorado, on Friday, 7th of January, marked his sixth climate disaster tour since taking office a year ago. Underscoring the growing threat of global heating in the United States and the need for radical action to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Recent prairie grass fire destroyed almost 1,100 homes and some businesses after hurricane-force winds drove flames through two densely populated Denver suburbs, forcing 35,000 people to flee their homes. The cumulative effect of unusually wet conditions last spring, followed by extremely dry and warm conditions through to December, weather patterns linked to global heating, enabled the rare winter fire to scorch over 6,000 acres of land, engulfing residential neighborhoods and commercial districts alike. After meeting some of the affected families, Joe Biden praised the courage of survivors and admitted, "We can't ignore the reality of these fires are being supercharged. They're being supercharged by changing weather." The Colorado disaster capped a catastrophic year for the United States in which at least 650 people died from climate disasters, including heat waves, hurricanes, wildfires, and floods. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NCAA, the estimated economic cost of the destruction had topped $100 billion even before the Colorado blaze. A 69-year-old construction worker, Robert Sharp, has been confirmed dead, while another person remains unaccounted for. The cause of the wildfire remains under investigation. Joe Biden's latest disaster tour underlines the stakes of his teetering Build Back Better legislation, which earmarks $550 billion to tackle the largest sources of global heating gases, energy and transportation. The bill's passage has been impeded by the fossil fuel-friendly Senator Joe Manchin, who angered his Democratic colleagues by opposing the historic social spending package that includes major investments in forest restoration, in wildfire resiliency and mitigation as part of what would be the country's largest ever climate crisis investment. Experts say that without the bill, it will be impossible to meet the administration's target of reducing greenhouse gas emissions to at least 50% below 2005 levels by 2030. Globally, the United States is the second largest emitter of greenhouse gases, and scientists have warned that even halving emissions by 2030 may not be enough to avoid a catastrophic rise in atmospheric and oceanic temperatures, which elevate the risk of wildfires, intensify droughts and rainstorms, and exacerbate flooding. Vijay Limaya, a climate and health scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council Science Center, said, "In the last few months, we've seen vivid examples of the extraordinary costs the country is shouldering because of climate change, and the problem is worsening day by day." Vijay Limaya added, "The tremendous benefits of the adaptation and mitigation measures in Build Back Better would far outweigh the costs." As the Biden administration battles to rescue the legislation and get it through the Senate, there are growing calls to accelerate reforms needed to modernize government agencies so that they're equipped for climate disasters and extreme weather events. Joe Manchin's vote is crucial as the bill is opposed by Republicans. On Friday, the Colorado Democratic Congressman Joe Neguse, K co-chair of the bipartisan Wildfire Caucus, unveiled a new bill to help prevent future wildfires, fund state-of-the-art firefighting equipment and programs, and support recovery efforts for communities and forests affected by wildfires across western United States. Joe Nagusa said, "As we endure increasingly worse wildfire seasons, it is critical for the federal government to lend a hand in stopping wildfires before they start, fighting them if they spread, and helping our communities fully recover after they've been contained. We cannot expect our communities to bear the burden of these disasters on their own." The Western Wildfire Support Act, co-sponsored by Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada, would direct the Departments of the Interior and Agriculture to create fire prevention, fire management, and recovery plans for federal land across the western United States. It would also provide $100 million in funding to help communities impacted by wildfires conduct long-term rehabilitation projects. Colorado Democratic Congressman Joe Nagusa, whose district includes Boulder County, Colorado, launched the Wildfire Caucus after the unprecedented 2020 season, when more than 1,000 fires destroyed 665,454 acres of land in Colorado alone. Last year, more than 8,600 wildfires were recorded in California, a historic high that caused over 2.5 million acres of land to burn. Exposure to wildfire smoke can cause serious health problems, such as asthma attacks and pneumonia. It can worsen chronic heart and lung diseases and can increase the risk of lower birth weights if pregnant women are exposed. Yet, while damage to property is well tracked, there are no national statistics on hospital admissions or other health impacts of wildfires or any climate disasters. Vijay Limaya said climate-related health tracking is in very poor shape nationally. We barely have a handle on the physical health implications, never mind the impact on mental health of people. Yet the scale of the health and social costs are likely to be substantial, given that in 2021 alone, according to an analysis by the Washington Post, more than 4 in 10 Americans lived in a county struck by climate disaster. The Washington Post analysis found that about 15% of the American people live in counties where wildfire disasters were declared in 2021, and the conditions necessary for fire, high temperatures, low rainfall, and high winds last on average more than a month longer than they did four decades ago. If the planet continues to heat up, research suggests that by mid-century, the fire season could lengthen by another 23 days. As Build Back Better stalls and the drilling of fossil fuel continues apace, it's a race against time to ensure government agencies, regulations, and standards are fit for purpose, as drought, flooding, and other extreme weather events will almost certainly continue to escalate. President Biden claimed that he has reinstated some climate-smart standards rescinded by his predecessor Donald Trump, such as requiring all federally funded projects to take into account the long-term risk of flooding and sea level rise. But according to the NRDC analyst Rob Moore, most building and land use standards remain woefully outdated. Learning from past mistakes is also key. A group of lawmakers from states bearing the brunt of extreme weather events, that is Hawaii, Louisiana, and California, support creating a National Disaster Safety Board, modeled on the body that investigates aviation accidents to help identify and correct the factors that contributed to a hazard, such as a storm or a wildfire, becoming a full-blown climate disaster. Rob Moore said, "The board would be a tremendous addition to coping with climate disasters nationally and accelerate climate adaptation efforts. Extreme weather events are no longer an act of God. They are systemic and endemic problems which we need to plan for.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
We've been discussing the effect of the Shahada of the Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha and her choice to be a Shahida. The last point regarding the Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha and the effects of that shahada that we want to discuss has to do with the effect of the shahada of Fatima al-Zahra on not the enemies and not the believers who were following her already, but on the mustadafin, on those who have not heard of Islam, on those who have not heard of the Ahlul Bayt, those who have been given misinformation regarding the Ahlul Bayt, those who've been given misinformation in regards to Islam, in regards to the Prophet, in regards to the Quran, in regards to the teachings of the Quran, in regards to the various rulings of Islam. There are many people throughout the globe today and before this, who either because of, apparently from a human perspective, because of the tyranny of the tyrants, the word of the Ahlul Bayt, the word of true Islam, the real word of the Prophet, the real tafsir of the Quran itself didn't arrive in their localities, they didn't hear about it. Or if they heard it, which at that time, in Europe, they heard about Islam. During the lifetime of the Prophet, some people at least heard about Islam. Eventually, everyone pretty much came to know of Islam, and they heard of Islam. But what did they hear of Islam? Complete misrepresentations of the Prophet of Islam. Similar in many ways to the current times where those who hear of Islam in the world outside of Muslim families and outside of Muslim lands, what people hear of Islam and what they think is right about Islam is a lot of nonsense, a lot of misrepresentations. And because of that, they have not accepted. Because what they think Islam is, they shouldn't accept. Because that which is called Islam in the way Islam is presented to them is actually injustice, is actually wrong. So that wrong thing that is called Islam that they receive, they're obviously supposed to reject that. So the correct way to put this is that they really haven't heard of Islam as it is. They've heard of something else that's called Islam. They call it, they misrepresent it, and they call it Islam so that people think real Islam is that. These people, did the Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha have an impact on the mustadafin or not? Does it have an impact on the mustadafin or not? Well, obviously, if we're discussing it, then you probably think we're going to say yes, and yes, that is the answer. It has and will continue to have effects and an impact on the mustadafin, those who have been given false and misinformation regarding Islam. Before I talk about the effect of it, let me explain this idea. The majority of the people during the life of the Imams, during the life of Fatima al-Zahra in that short period after the demise of the Prophet, during the life of the Prophet even outside of those who had accepted Islam, or during the time when the Prophet was preaching and their tribes hadn't accepted, the majority of people are mustadhafin. People at the time of the Prophet heard what the Prophet had to say. Did they hear it from him directly? A lot of those Arab tribes, no, they didn't. What did they hear? They heard what Abu Sufyan said about what the Prophet is saying. They heard what Abu Jahl said about what the Prophet is saying. They heard what Abu Lahab, their leaders. Their leaders found the words of the Prophet to be effective, attractive. So they misrepresented it. They said it's magic. They said he's a lunatic. They twisted his words. They did all kinds of stuff to get people not to want to even hear what the Prophet has to say. That person who rejects the Prophet doesn't really know him, doesn't really know what his teaching is. They just hear a misrepresentation. The majority of the people were mustadhafin. And so as soon as the barrier of the kuffar, those who really were against the Prophet, those who were spreading these lies against the Prophet, as soon as they were out of the way, in what way? After the conquest of Mecca, they didn't have authority anymore. The conquest of Mecca happened in this way. The Prophet took his army and they secretly planned. These are all ways that he did it with no bloodshed. One of the tactics was to have a very secret plan. So nobody knows when this army is going to move. The Kuffar had a gut feeling and they tried to get clarification that the Prophet is planning to conquer Mecca. He's planning an attack. So they were afraid. They're trying to figure out when and so on. The Holy Prophet planned it very carefully. They made their way, that huge army made its way from Medina all the way to Mecca without the Meccans knowing. Next thing they know, Abu Sufyan wakes up. They hear that the Prophet's army is right outside of town. There's nothing to do. You can't run. You're either going to fight or you're going to have to surrender. Those are the two options you have. Obviously, Abu Sufyan is not ready to die. He's the leader of this kufr. That's why the kufr at the time of the occultation, the rise of the kufr is... The term used in our ahadith is Sufyani, because he was the head. Abu Sufyan was the head of Kufr at the time against the Prophet. The head of Kufr at the time of the occultation is called Sufyani, attributing or drawing a parallel and a comparison between this movement and what Abu Sufyan was doing against Islam. Anyhow, they were the obstacles. The way the Prophet planned it, they came, they surrendered to the Prophet. And they said, we're Muslim. After that, they couldn't. They hated the Prophet still. The Holy Prophet, though, didn't kill them. That wasn't part of the deal. That's not what God wanted. If they surrender, okay. There's no war. But once they surrendered, that's the effect. They were leading this misrepresentation. And they had authority in the land. And their voices were heard. Now that they accepted, now that they couldn't speak ill, now that they joined the ranks of the musallin, those who are praying, now they joined the congregations of prayer, be it that they don't believe in it at heart, but once they do this, then there is that negative voice that was constantly being heard and was able to get their message across to these masses is not heard. What happens? إِذَا جَاءَ نَصْرُ اللَّهِ وَالْفَتْحُ وَرَأَيْتَ النَّاسِ يَدْخُلُونَ فِي دِينِ اللَّهِ أَفْوَاجًا. These masses that were mustadhafin, that barrier that kept them from hearing of Islam, allowing themselves to hear what the Prophet says, those barriers were removed. Now they see it. They accept it. They accept it. So the majority, even at that time, were mustadhafin. People who aren't really thinking for themselves. They're following their leaders.
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء.
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء.
فاطم الزهراء.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The saturation coverage of the anniversary of the 6th of January insurrection and of Donald Trump's attempt to bully his way into a reversal of his loss in the 2020 presidential election has felt dispiriting. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by Richard L. Hansen, a professor of law and political science at the University of California at Irvine. He's also the author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. The article has been published in the New York Times opinion section. It is titled, No One Is Coming to Save Us from the Dagger at the Throat of America. As we all know, the hyper-polarized, social media-driven information environment makes it virtually impossible to persuade those voters that the 2020 presidential election was fairly run. Those who believe the last election was stolen will be more likely to accept a stolen election for their side next time. They are more willing to see violence as a means of resolving election disputes. Political operatives are laying the groundwork for future election sabotage and the federal government has done precious little to minimize the risk. Many people who are not dispirited by such findings are uninterested, exhausted by 4 years of the Trump presidency and a lingering pandemic. Some Americans appear to have responded to the risk to our democracy by simply tuning out of the news and hoping that things will just work out politically by 2024. We must not succumb to despair or to indifference. It won't be easy, but there is a path forward if we begin acting now, together, to shore up our fragile election ecosystem. Let's begin by reviewing some of the key problems. Those who administer elections have faced threats of violence and harassment. 1/4 of election administrators say that they plan to retire before 2024. Republican election and elected officials who stood up to Donald Trump's attempt to rig the 2020 vote count, like Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who refused Donald Trump's entreaties to find 11,780 votes to flip the election to him, are being pushed out or challenged for their jobs in primaries by people embracing Mr. Trump's false claims, like Representative Jody Heiss. The new Republicans running elections or certifying or counting votes may have more allegiance to Donald Trump or his successor in 2024 than to a fair vote count, creating conditions for Democrats to join Republicans in believing the election system is rigged. If Jody Heiss is Georgia's Secretary of State in 2024 and declares Donald Trump the winner of the 2024 election after having embraced the lie that Mr. Trump won Georgia in 2020, which Democrats will accept that result? Trumpist election administrators and Donald Trump's meddling in Republican primaries and gerrymandered Republican legislatures and congressional districts create dangerous electoral conditions. They make it more likely that state legislatures will try to overturn the will of the people. As Donald Trump unsuccessfully urged in 2020, and select alternative slates of presidential electors if a Democrat wins in their state in 2024. A Republican majority in the U.S. House of Representatives in 2025 could count the rogue, legislatively submitted slates of presidential electors instead of those fairly reflecting actual election results in the states. In the meantime, some Republican states are passing or considering additional laws that would make election sabotage more likely. The federal government so far has taken few steps to increase the odds of free and fair elections in 2024. Despite the barely bipartisan impeachment of Mr. Trump for inciting an insurrection and the barely bipartisan majority vote in the U.S. Senate for conviction, Mr. Trump was neither convicted under the necessary two-thirds vote of the Senate nor barred from running for office again by Congress, as he could have been under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment for inciting insurrection. While the Department of Justice has prosecuted the rioters, obtaining convictions and plea agreements for hundreds of people who trespassed and committed violence, so far no one in Donald Trump's circle, much less Donald Trump himself, has been charged with federal crimes connected to the 6th of January events. He faces potential criminal action in Georgia for his call with Mr. Raffensperger, but neither indictment nor conviction by a jury is assured. Congress has fallen down too. House and Senate Republicans bear the greatest share of the blame. Some were just fine with Donald Trump's authoritarian tendencies. Others abhorred his actions but have done nothing of substance to counteract these risks. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell gave an impassioned speech against Donald Trump's actions after the 6th of January 2021. But he did not vote for conviction, perhaps fearing the wrath of the Republican base. More surprisingly, Democratic House and Senate leaders have not acted as if the very survival of American democracy is at issue, even though leading global experts on Democratic backsliding and transitions into authoritarianism have been sounding the alarm bells. President Biden put it well in his 6th of January anniversary speech about Donald Trump and his allies holding a dagger at the throat of America, at American democracy. But we need action and not just strong words. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Lady Fatima's personality, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, February 19th, 2018.
The people of her time, of other times, and we in this era are not able to recognize the brilliance and splendor of her spirituality. The bright light of spirituality is not detected by everyone's eye. Our short-sighted and weak eyes are unable to see the luminosity of humanity in these great personalities. Therefore, we do not discuss the definition of Fatima's alayhi salam spirituality. However, in her ordinary life, there's an important point. On the one hand, as a Muslim woman, she perfectly performs her duties at home and behaves nicely towards her husband and children. On the other hand, as a zealous, tireless person, she acts for her cause. In political events, shortly after the death of her father, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, she went to the mosque, gave a speech, expressed her position, and defended her cause. Hence, she represented a marvelous fighting personality that is tireless, enduring, and tolerant. The third aspect of her life reveals her as a devotee of Allah, who performs prayers in the dark of the nights, uprises for Allah, and is humble before Allah.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Combining these three dimensions is the luminous point in the life of Fatima alayhi salam. She did not separate the three dimensions. Some people think that those who worship Allah are only concerned with prayer and worship and cannot be involved in politics. Or some people think that those women and men who are active in politics and the arena of jihad on the path of Allah, if a woman, she cannot perform her duties at home as a mother and a wife. And as a man, he cannot be a good businessman, husband, or a father. They think these qualities are contradictory. Whereas in the view of Islam, these aspects not only reveal that there are no contradictions, but they are also helpful towards achieving the perfect human personality.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.